Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of Zero to Agile, the podcast about, well, anything agile. I am your host, Phil Chipixee. Today, I have the pleasure of bringing to you the audio of a Agile Q&A panel that I sit on. We do these about once a month with Joel Semenyuk. You might remember him as a guest on my very first episode of this podcast, as well as Steve Porter and Ramiro Milan, and the four of us field questions from the audience in a webinar format. And I thought, you know, great content, love to get it out to a wider audience, and so here it is. I've taken the 12 questions that were asked and answered and turned it into the next two episodes. If you like the content of this webinar, you can access this and all of our webinars via tinyurl.com/agilewebinars, and that's all one word with agile webinars. tinyurl.com/agilewebinars. So without further ado, let's get on with the show. Thank you.
I did want to welcome everyone to the Challenges of Adopting Agile. This is our QA panel that we do on a regular basis. This is obviously March 9th today. We have a great group of panelists here that are going to answer those questions. All right, so let's start with some formal introductions. My name is Ramiro Milan. I'm the Agile Process Consultant, and you've probably seen me do the webinars, weekly webinars, release webinars. I'm a certified product owner, certified Scrum Master, worked as a developer, came to Telerik to help with the Team Pulse project. So if you don't follow me on Twitter, it's at Ramiro Milan. I like to tweet as anything that's on my mind. Sometimes it's about my kids. Sometimes it's about being stuck in traffic. Who knows? So with that said, I'll turn it over to Joel, who is our Executive Vice President of our division.
My name is Joel. As Ramiro said, I'm the Executive Vice President for the Team Pulse division. I've been around, been doing Agile, working with Agile customers even before we called it Agile, probably close to 15 years now. It was really about how teams work together. One of the books that really inspired me to think more about Agile and Agile processes is a book called PeopleWare by Tom DeMarco. Really got me thinking about the way people work and what we can learn from that and apply that to our teams. And, you know, and we slowly see the emergence of Agile and different Agile techniques that really reflect a lot of that stuff. So I'm really quite passionate about the Agile space, as well as, you know, whatever we can do to work with teams to make them more productive. And again, on Twitter, you can always follow me at Joel Semenyuk. I tweet quite a bit, mostly actually about Agile stuff. So please follow me if you get a chance, and I hope to see you online.
Great. Thanks, Joel. And with us today, we actually have Steve Porter, who's a regular on the QA panel. So I'll let Steve introduce himself.
Thanks, Ramiro. My name is Steve Porter. I'm currently the Team Pulse product owner, but I, like Joel, have been doing Agile for many years, not quite as many as he has. And I've been doing all sorts of software development before I started working with Agile pieces in particular. So not quite as active on Twitter, but looking forward to answering any questions you might have. My current focus is being a product owner, so I like to think I have a really good handle on that particular side of Agile and that particular focus from a management product owner standpoint. So looking forward to helping people out today.
Thanks, Steve. Evil management product owner. Awesome. Also, we have Phil Chipixee, who's our Agile Practice Evangelist. You've probably seen Phil do the release webinars with me. Great friend, I would say. Great guy. So I will let him introduce himself.
Great. Thanks, Ramiro. So yeah, I'm Phil Chipixee. I'm the Agile Practices Evangelist. I'm a Microsoft MVP and also a certified solution developer, as well as a DBA and a Scrum Master and a Scrum Practitioner. I'm also the host of the mildly popular Zero to Agile podcast, and we'll have details about that later in the show or later in this panel. So I come with 20-plus years of consulting background. I joined Telerik about a year and a half ago, and really done a lot of Agile coaching and transformations and helping teams apply more software engineering practices within Agile, as well as helping them get along with the non-engineering divisions. So glad you guys could join us.
Thanks, Phil. Okay, so the first question that we will be working with today My team wants to use Agile methodologies, but our PMO likes Waterfall to track multiple teams. And I'm going to go ahead and turn that over to Joel, I think, who's going to go ahead and start with this question.
Sure. I've done a lot of work with high-level management executives around the adoption of Agile. And it's actually interesting that I haven't yet come across PMOs who say we must be Waterfall, but they're actually looking for pieces of information. So the job of a PMO is to help protect the organization, to make sure that they're reducing risk and trying to capture learnings of the organization and put it into practices that are followed by other organizations. And they're all looking for signs that something could be wrong as well on a project. So they look at things like budget variance. They take a look at things like the overall progress on a project. They take a look at scheduling issues. They take a look at changes. They take a look at all these things. And these things are not absent in Agile. In fact, most Agile teams track quite well. There's quite a bit of metrics that that Agile teams naturally capture. They naturally capture things like how fast their team produces value. They naturally break down their work into small bite-sized chunks, normally called sprints or iterations. These have milestones that are very easy for a PMO to follow. We can either group these milestones together in releases or phases that, again, is in perfect language from the PMO perspective. So I think one of the things that I've always tried to do is try to match up the needs of what the PMO wants to see with what is being produced at the Agile team level. Those needs actually aren't mutually exclusive. The PMO really wants to ensure that the organization is producing upon expectation. Now, interestingly enough, Agile is all about producing upon expectation. One of the very common practices that we see, and it's especially highlighted in Scrum, is that we take a short iteration, anywhere between 1 to 4 weeks, and we try to make sure that we do a bit of planning around that, and we get the team to commit to achieving those, what the expectations set out in that iteration. Now, that does a whole bunch of different things. First of all, it helps us build trust, not only between the customer and the development team, but the development team in itself. But it also allows us to have very distinct milestones that we can catch where problems might be going wrong on a project, so we can offer corrective guidance. So from a PMO's perspective, they're really kind of concerned about these things. And I'm going to kind of follow off by their, PMOs look to organizations like PMI quite a bit to help provide them with some knowledge, global knowledge about how to manage these things. And PMI has done a very, very good job at starting to adopt and bring in Agile principles and making it part of what PMI considers very, very valid practices in the project management world, even outside of software development. So the PMOs, Agile is not going away. It's growing in strength. And the value that we can produce in terms of metrics and early signs of problems are actually more pronounced in Agile than they would be inside of more traditional models.
So the piece that you may run into a bit of trouble here, and I noticed the question, it's interesting how it's worded, where it's my team wants to use Agile methodology, but the PMO likes to track Waterfall, likes Waterfall to track multiple teams. You may run into the case where you have a PMO who has tracking many different projects, and I've worked with organizations that had PMOs that weren't just tracking software development projects. They were actually tracking many different types of projects, all under one PMO. And one of the things they don't like is that I've got one team over here doing different stuff, and they're doing their own thing. And that makes it really hard for me to then report across all the other areas. So as Joel mentioned, I think the really important thing you need to do with the PMO is to really engage the PMO and say, what do you need? What do you need from me, and how do you need this information? Because most likely I'm tracking all the stuff that you need, but maybe I'm not using the right language. Maybe I'm using different languages or different formats, or I might be using something slightly different that just doesn't fit into your cookie cutter way of managing items, which I understand you need, because you're tracking so many different things. If you don't have cookie cutters, then it's hard to track one thing against another. So work really closely with them to say, okay, what do you need? And then figure out how can I take what I'm producing and make it fit inside of what you're doing. And there may be some difficulties there initially, but I think most PMOs are quite reasonable. If you can show them, hey, we're actually being very transparent, very open, we're actually doing a lot of things here that you will appreciate, and it just may be a matter of translation, then focus on what their need is, and then solving that problem might just be the translation problem. Because if you can give them the data that they want and you can format it correctly for them, they shouldn't have any constraints or any concerns with that. Phil, you had something you wanted to add?
Yeah, absolutely. And great answers as always. And I'm going to take a little different approach. The biggest problems that I've seen with PMO offices not wanting to adopt Agile is fear of the unknown. It's who moved my cheese, right? Because they've been doing things a certain way for quite a while. And now, you know, some guys are coming in and saying, well, you've been doing it wrong your entire career. We're going to show you how to do things differently, right? And so first and foremost, it's education both ways, right? We can't just assume as Agile coaches and Agilists that we're going to come in and everything they're doing is wrong and everything that we're going to tell them is right. And so we need to educate ourselves on how they currently do their business, but we also have to educate them, as Steve and Joel were talking about, on what Agile is, right? And it's not, you know, this whole upside-down transformation, everybody has to wear Birkenstocks and sing Kumbaya, right? There are some driving principles that Steve and Joel, you know, defined very well and talked about. But my approach would be an education one. Sit down with them and, you know, find out which Agile myth they subscribe to, right? You know, because we have all these myths out there. Like, Agile means no documentation, and Agile means no architecture and these things. And, you know, if you can dispel the myths and, again, you know, find out what they need to make their job complete and show how Agile can do that, even better yet, don't even use the word Agile. Right? Just talk about, hey, you know, we want to eliminate waste. Does that sound like a good idea? Hey, we want to increase communication. Does that sound like a good idea? Here's some ways we can do that. So really, I would stress on top of everything else, education, but both ways, right? Not just you're going to come in and show them how to do their job, but you need to get educated on their jobs and what they're trying to accomplish. And at the same time, you can educate them on how you can help them do their jobs better.
Great. Thanks, Phil. So we're actually going to change a little bit of gears and open up another question that came live from the audience. So has Agile shifted too much from the original manifesto with the focus on result and client into an internal process about management and development process? So I think Steve wanted to go ahead and start that one, so I'll let him chime in on that.
Definitely there has been some shifting going on, and I'm not convinced necessarily been bad shifting. I think what's been happening is over the past 10 years since the manifesto has been released, Agile has grown. And I think as it's grown, more people starting to use it, it's like anything, it's evolving, we're adapting to it. One of my favorite examples of that is I'm fairly well involved with Scrum.org, and Ken and Jeff just released an update to their guide to Scrum that took some of the things that they were seeing, which were some of the changes in focus for what the original goal of Scrum was, and to add some changes to it, to make some clarifications, to, I think, deal with that shift that people have been seeing. One of my absolute favorite shifts was the original guide to Scrum talked about commitment, that the teams committed for every sprint, and what they were finding and what people were finding out in the field is that term commitment was lost, didn't translate well. It went from what their goal was to have the team coalesce around something that they're focusing on to something that you beat people over the head with because you committed to do something, so that means that you're working over the weekend for free because you committed something. So has things shifted? Yes, and I don't think that's a surprise, but the nice thing about it is that it always allows things to shift back and to move, and Agile is adopting and it's growing, and I don't think that's necessarily anything bad. Did someone else want it to go next, Phil?
Yep, that'll be me. So I think Agile definitely has shifted, and I don't know if it shifted more towards the management development process, but if you look at the original manifesto and the guiding principles, it talks a lot about clients, but doesn't talk about users, right? And I think that was a big miss. It's all about the development team interacting with the client. Well, who's the client typically? It might be a stakeholder. It might be an internal product team. It might be, you know, somebody. But it's not the actual user. And I think one of the biggest shifts I've seen, even in just the past year, is a conscious effort to include into the Agile processes the user. And that means bringing in user interface, user experience, or what we've always called human factors type folks into the process. And that's a big shift, right? Because a lot of the people who wear the black berets and turtlenecks don't really want to come down off the mountain. And I'm not trying to say that to all, but we've all dealt with some designers who are designers, right? And we've felt that little bit of contention, and they want to make their Photoshop things do a little bit of seagull design. And what I mean by that is they'll swoop in like a seagull and poop out their design and swoop off to the next project. And what we're finding is that more and more designers are realizing that everything gets better when we all work together. And so we're seeing a greater focus on not only improving the processes within the organization and within the dev team, eliminating waste and all those benefits, also increased benefit to the clients, you know, who's paying for this usually, but also a significant improvement to the user. And that's the biggest shift I've seen. Joel?
Yeah, and I'll even step outside of it. I think that if Agile doesn't mature, it's not very Agile. I actually see a great deal of flux happening. I don't think anyone's questioning at all the original intent of the manifesto, but if we go back in time, we'll realize that the original manifesto was released, and then shortly thereafter, we came up with the practices. But there's been quite a bit of, you know, as it's being adopted, more and more people with different perspectives are trying to figure out how this makes sense to them. One of the guys that I really kind of look to for seeing, you know, helping to drive some of this thought leadership is a guy by the name of Scott Ambler. You can see some of his stuff on Ambisoft, AmbySoft.com, that talks a lot about Agile and CMMI and actually how it's, you know, something called disciplined Agile. So we're seeing quite a bit of evolution happening, and we're also starting to see influence from the lean manufacturing side of the fence. You know, I've been preaching about lean for a very, very long time because I believe that in many ways lean describes why Agile works. And taking, you know, the seven basic principles of lean and applying it to software development teams helps you actually discover Agile and Agile practices. You know, and we're starting to get, I think, a much more mature view of what agility is when we consider all of these different influences that, and all of our goals is there to reduce waste and increase the rate of value or the flow of value in any system, right? And lean has been doing that for 50 years, and we've had, you know, various attempts at helping doing that as well, just responding to waste. For example, if you look at CMMI, one of the reasons that CMMI was invented was in response to a huge amount of waste that was being observed by the government. So in all sense, I think that we are seeing a shift of agility, you know, the core, you know, what we as developers have kind of learned to adopt to something that is much more ingrained in management structures. And, you know, we continually talk about how we're interacting with PMOs, and this is just a good example. A lot of our struggles is, in fact, interacting with PMOs, is, in fact, interacting with business and customers and helping us figure out ways to communicate, but more importantly, understanding waste and figuring out how to get that waste out of our system, and that's why we do Agile. And I think that that acknowledgement is sparking the evolution that we're seeing it. And I'm really excited to be, you know, to see that evolution. And I think that there's enough great minds that are helping it evolve to make sure that we're not going to lose the core premise of it, that that the real goal is actually about producing as much business value and customer value as possible by reducing waste.
Hey, did you know that Team Pulse is a simple and intuitive project management tool based on Agile best practices? By taking advantage of its unique best practices analyzer, your team can adopt Agile easily and painlessly, one step at a time. The analyzer automatically evaluates and then reports the project elements that do not conform to Agile best practices, allowing you to address problems early on and adjust. And now, back to the show.
Really, really, really good points there with regards to what the original manifesto intended to be and what it's turning into now. And with that said, there's actually, you know, a comment that came up from the audience today that I'd like to kind of introduce out there, and it's a comment slash question, but it's a really strong opinion, an opinion that I see a lot on the field as well, and it is, my opinion is there is nothing wrong in waterfall. Agile is other way of doing things, isn't it? So it's a question and an opinion, and I'll turn that over to Phil. I think he wanted to take a crack at that first.
Is there anything wrong with doing it? Well, let me just throw an aside in there. I always hear, waterfall works fine, look at NASA, right? Everybody says NASA's so waterfall. But if you look at the history of the space program, they didn't go from, you know, zero to landing on the moon in one try. Right, they even iterated. Right, they you know, first, can we get a rocket? Can we get a monkey in space? Can we get a man in space? Can we circumnavigate the globe? You know, those types of things. So they even iterated through it. So waterfall, in its, I'll say, purest definition, is probably okay for some things. What we lose is the fact that, and interesting, I just recorded a podcast on this, which should be coming out fairly soon. What we lose is the ability to deal with the reality of software. A lot of the concepts of waterfall and even the terms come from building architecture, right? The physical architecture, and whether it's buildings or bridges or roads or whatever, right? If you look at it, even, you know, we have design, we have construction, you know, we have all these terms. And the problem with waterfall in reality versus on paper is we live in a much more dynamic world with software than we do with building bridges. You build a bridge, it's supposed to last, you know, almost forever, right? And when you build a bridge once, you can pretty much take the exact same plan, maybe change the height, maybe change the length, maybe change the width, but it's really the same plan. It is a cookie cutter. And you're going to take that from place to place to place. We don't have that luxury with software. If you were building the exact same thing more than once, I'd say you probably should have just reused what you did before, right? And you can even say, well, I'm building e-commerce sites. They're always the same. Well, if they were always the same, then, again, you shouldn't be building a new site. There's always changes. The market is much more dynamic. We're looking at software projects that only last a couple of years, not because of, you know, the technology dying per se, but much more because of the market changes so fast. So we need something with a much more rapid feedback loop than the big design up front or the I'm going to design everything up front because I know everything before I start writing a line of code. So, you know, to make a short story long, waterfall can work. And in some places, it's probably still a very, very good way to do it. If you look at machine automation and PLC code and things like that, it's probably the right thing to do. But for most software projects that are much more dynamic than building a bridge or building a house, we had to do something different, and hence the birth of, you know, the Agile movements.
Interesting you brought up NASA. I remember seeing a slide, and I don't know whether it's true or not. It's one of those facts that I can't confirm. But the cost of the lines of code at NASA were much higher than when you looked at the average cost of line of code for most organizations. So there is a cost to that that waterfall mentality that a lot of companies just aren't willing to pay. A around whether waterfall works or not. Absolutely. Like, absolutely, there are successful waterfall projects. And I think, as Phil has pointed out, it just, for many, many software development projects, because of the way that they are, it's going to be very difficult to get. It may be difficult for waterfall to work correctly. If you've got a super smart group of people, and they're all kind of co-located with the business people, and they work out a plan as a group together, you may very well be able to get waterfall to work correctly. But for most software development projects, I think you're going to struggle with it. One of the ways that I like to look at it is you often have different levels of complexity for problems you're trying to solve. So you have very simple problems, you have complex problems, you have complicated problems, and then you've got chaos. And it's all around whether, you know, your knowns are more than your unknowns. And if you have a very simple problem that you're trying to solve, or a simple set of problems you're trying to solve where you know more than you don't know, and things aren't going to change that often, then waterfall may be the best way for you to go. But for a lot of software development projects, there are a lot of unknowns. And because there are a lot of unknowns, you are going to be better off managing that by taking the unknowns into account and by agreeing that things are going to change and we just need to deal with those.
And just like you guys, I'm going to approach this completely sideways, differently, I guess, than what you guys are approaching it. First of all, there's something called the waterfall myth. It's interesting. There's no real such thing as the waterfall methodology. The term waterfall actually was introduced in a collection of in an article that talked about a collection of different manufacturing styles. This was highlighted very well in a book called SDL 3.0, written by a guy by the name of Mark Kennelly, a fellow Canadian, I might add, super smart guy, but really kind of said that, you know, in this paper, it didn't just say that waterfall was the alternative to agile. It talked about a number of different patterns. We just somehow got into this line of thinking that there was only one quote-unquote waterfall model, and then all the rest is iterative or agile. Another myth is that, you know, if you do agile, that's the only way you can succeed. I'm going to point out that I've seen my share of failed agile projects. Agile is not the medicine pill. It's actually the pill that you take when you want to expose your problems. You have a pretty high risk of failure if you're not going to fix those problems. Another myth that I kind of want to point out is that agile and waterfall kind of deal with some different things. The guy's already talked about uncertainty and change. But agile talks a lot about how people work. One of the things that what really excited me about, you know, agile and extreme programming and Scrum was that it was a recognition that building anything, whether it be a bridge or anything, is really a people problem, not a technology one. And agile really brings this to the surface. Why do we want an engaged customer? Because of the people problem, because of how we communicate and share information and knowledge with one another. You know, but we see all these patterns again and again in other types of methodologies, like in Lean, for example. We see very wasteful things, and we see that the human condition itself works to add these wastes to the process. So agile is much more than just about, you know, dealing with uncertainty or dealing with change. It deals with people problems, and it also is there to help expose waste. Your job is to help, you know, resolve those wastes by adapting your team. And it's very interesting. I used to work for IBM years and years and years ago as a project manager. And, you know, after I got out of therapy, I'm just kidding. Maybe not. We looked at our big projects, and it was very funny because we had a waterfallish type of methodology. It's quite linear, quite plan up front heavy. But what we ended up doing is on complicated projects that had high variability of change or high probability of change, we broke our projects down into phases. Ironically, these phases were about a month to 2 months long. And, you know, we would kind of plan out these phases very loosely, and then really kind of replan each phase as we get into it. And it's kind of interesting how, you know, some of that mindset, even though it was very much a linear progress, very much a waterfall, you know, we see some of those patterns even in things like Scrum today. Scrum doesn't say you can never, you know, understand the end date of your project. But it does say that you should replan. It doesn't say that, and it says you should plan as when you have the most knowledge, just in time. But it doesn't ever say that you can never figure out when you're done or you know, the project, or be predictive in anything like schedule or budget. It embraces some of these issues around being able to adapt to change and being able to adapt to uncertainty, but also importantly, being able to find waste in your own team so that you can correct it and address some of those people problems. So again, if you're interested in reading a really excellent book, it's called SDLC 3.0, Beyond the Tacit Understanding of Agile. I recommend this book everywhere. It's a very fresh look at Agile and how it's evolving. And it's in fact addressing that exact evolutionary thing that we talked about at the very first question, the second question. So go ahead and reach into that.
Great. So we have another question, and it's, we have a team that is responsible for developing and maintaining several internal products. We have siloed our skill sets to match the technologies of the different products and form cross-skill set teams by project. So in the Agile challenge that they face is to try to put this into a single company system backlog and multiple backlogs per product and crossing resources between teams working on each other's backlogs. And it's creating a situation where just basically they're having difficulties on how to get it to work. So Phil wanted to go ahead and start answering this this question.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Ramiro. So there's a couple things that I see here that it kind of make the hair on the back of my neck stand up a little bit. And the first thing is the multiple backlogs, right? So I don't know how many of you guys have seen Office Space, and if you haven't, I highly recommend it. But, you know, one of the things that the protagonist in Office Space was complaining about is he had three different bosses, right? And he could never keep any of them happy, so he just did nothing. When you give developers multiple lists to choose from, there's no real way to control it, right? Because the highest priority item on one list might only rank 20th on another list, right? The developers are then going to pick and choose what they want to do versus what the business or the project needs them to do. So having multiple backlogs that multiple teams can draw from, or even a single team can draw from, can be very problematic. That's one of the reasons why I always stress to my teams that you shouldn't have a bug list and separate from a backlog. Bugs should go onto the backlog and be prioritized with everything in there. The second is the siloing. I'm very against siloing in any way, shape, or form. I was always very insistent that QA and documentation, when I was doing healthcare, because we always had to have documentation experts, the designers, project managers, all sat with the team, at least part at a time. All right, so we have very cross-functional teams and not solid by skill or by job title. And when you do that, you raise everybody's awareness up of what everybody else is trying to do. The communication's there because when, you know, two developers are asking about a feature and the QA hears that them talking about it, the QA can chime in and say, I don't think you understand. I don't think that means what you think it means. Right, and you can get that dialogue done before you're writing code. So I guess the biggest problems, and maybe this is a management mandate, guess what, we're going to be siloed and there's no way around it. And if that's so, then I would work very hard on getting rid of the multiple backlogs. I guess a couple things I would suggest, and first and foremost, is you got to keep in mind the 10% rule, right? And that is, if you try and change the way people do things by more than 10% of the time, you're going to face rebellion and failure, right? So you can't go in and try and do a sweeping change. You have to pick your battles. To me, from what you described, I'm still not quite sure I buy into the siloing, but I think you can live with the siloing for now if you can get a unified backlog. And if you can work on that part of it, then people will understand, you know, then you've got company-wide prioritization and not pockets of prioritization, and you can be more effective in getting the highest valued items delivered out to your customers.
This is Joel. I feel your pain. I've seen it happen over and over and over again. I've worked with very, very large organizations, from energy organizations to militaries to, like I said, IBM in the past before, and financial organizations. I think you might want to consider taking a very interesting approach, and it has to deal with Kanban. Kanban is a very interesting process, and it really brings in incremental, and it can help facilitate incremental organizational change, especially across siloed or places. By first of all, you start off by, as Phil already kind of suggested, try to get all of your eggs in one basket so you can visualize them. You want to understand what a backlog looks like. But then second of all, you really want to visualize flow. And when you start to visualize flow of all these different silos, because one of the things that's really great about Kanban is that it acknowledges that there are skills gaps. It acknowledges that, you know, not everybody on the team can have, you know, can write the same amount of code, and that we're all equal and all that other kind of good stuff. It acknowledges that there are technology expertise and all these other things. But what you really want to start off with is to start visualizing your flow to make it as completely transparent as humanly possible. Then once you start visualizing the flow, right, you can then start by looking at, do things like putting work in progress limits on each of the different stages to make sure that your team, whatever skills they are and whatever silos that they're in, are focusing on getting to done. And when you start doing stuff like that, you'll start using the system that identifies pieces of waste, one piece at a time, by showing up as inefficiencies in these flows, and then you can address them one at a time. I've seen this work over and over again, especially for large organizations, to help incrementally make cross-department organizational changes with shared resources and shared silos. It eventually pulls in agile practices, but it doesn't need to start there. It's not a shotgun approach. It's a very incremental, needs-driven, very transparent process of actually looking at organizational change. So if you're interested, there's a really great book written by a guy by the name of David Anderson. I refer to his book quite a bit. It's called Kanban, K-A-N-B-A-N, and it describes some of these processes. And Kanban, again, is not necessarily for software development. It's been around for 50 or 60 years, but it really has been a catalyst for the introduction of agile practices, and it works especially well in disparate systems, siloed organizations, and cross-departmental stuff.
We do have another question that is up on deck, and it's, I'd be interested in knowing how you folks, Team Pulse team, explain pointing to folks with very entrenched in estimation and planning in hours, since they aren't supposed to equate to one another. And I believe Joel wants to take a crack at this one as well.
Yeah, this has been one of my passions for about 15 years now. In fact, if you go to my blog, Joel on Canada, joelfromcanada.com, you'll actually see some resources there about estimation. Let me start by saying that estimation is a required evil. I wrote an article a while back that says if you want better estimates, stop estimating. That's kind of the epitome of the whole process, which is by the time you actually have your processes in place, you should be able to measure, be much more predictable than guessing. What you want to do with estimation is prevent guessing, minimize unknowns. The less unknown you have to guess about, the more accurate your estimates will be. And there's a number of techniques that you can use to help with that. It turns out that a human being is not good at estimating hours. We're just not built for it. What we're actually quite good at doing from an estimation perspective, surprisingly accurate actually, statistically, is estimating sizes. Meaning that if I have one abstract concept and I compare it in a binary fashion to another abstract concept, I can tell you with good certainty which one of those things is bigger and by how many times it's bigger. And this has led to the concept of story points or t-shirt sizes. You know, this is, you know, in the world of story points, we have size 3. And if I, you know, some other story or requirement comes along, I can compare it against this thing that I'm very certain about. This, you know, maybe it's the creation of a client dialog box, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, that's a size 3. I arbitrarily assign it a number, and then when something else comes along, I can do a binary comparison to this thing that I know quite well, which I've already said is a 3. I can say, wow, this is twice as big as that, and so I might put a number like 6 on that. Now, those numbers don't equate to hours, absolutely not. But they do equate to it transitively. So in most organizations, you have a fixed team. In that fixed team, you have, we expect, I'm just going to use North America as an example, we expect 40 hours of work per time per person. So if I've got a team of 5 developers, well, I'm assuming that I have about 200 hours worth of productive work that's in that bucket. Now, when I take a look at a story of size 3 and a story of size 6, I can't immediately equate that to hours. It's very difficult without having some historic information. And so this is why in Agile we have a lot of every iteration is an opportunity for us to fine-tune our metrics. So every iteration we see how many stories of and we add up all the points that they add up to. Did we get done in a 2-week period of time? Oh, it turns out we got 60 story points done. Well, now we can see that there's a loose association, and I do stress a loose association, between hours worked and points. That doesn't mean that you should start estimating in hours again, but there is a way of turning in points into costs when you have built up over and over really good metrics. For example, the Team Pulse team that I work with every day here at Telerik has a pretty consistent velocity. They consistently produce about 60 story points every 2 weeks, which is the size of our sprints. And it's, if you take a look at our velocity charts, there's not a lot of variance there, and that's really good from a planning perspective, but it also allows me to understand how that correlates to cost, and cost is a derivation of hours and of people's time per se. One of the other things that we normally do is we estimate stories with size, with story points. But tasks can be estimated in hours because they're granular enough for us to do this. And so there is ways that you can get casual relationships into. Now, if you're really an advanced team, you can even go a step further and take a look at a metric called cycle time. Cycle time is, in my opinion, one of the best predictors of future performance. Essentially, you still need a few calibrations inside of your process, but you can essentially say that a story of size 4 usually takes my team 4 days to produce, right? And we use this data, this aggregate data over and over again to help us be more predictive. So when someone comes to you and says, well, how long will it take you to, do this story? You look at it and, well, it's twice as big as our baseline anchor, which is 4, so it's of 8. And so I can be quite predictive that it should take us this amount of time to do a story size of 8. And instead of guessing, you're actually using historical performance of your team to be much more predictive on how you estimate. And then I think the most important aspect of estimation is collaboration. The biggest issues around estimation is uncertainty. And one of the things that we stress is that estimation should be done collaboratively because it allows for discussion. So if I have one person on my team saying that it is size 14 and another guy saying that it's size 40, then we have something different in our head. And that opportunity for us to discuss those differences is what's going to allow us to be more certain in both of our estimates and also in the requirements that we're driving forth. So to help kind of reduce the variance overall.
Hey, that's our show for today. That's the end of part one. Stay tuned. Our next podcast will have the exciting conclusion. If you have any comments, concerns, or suggestions, you can reach out to us at telerik.com/zerotoagile. Follow us on Twitter at @zerotoagile, or send us an email at zerotoagile@telerik.com. See you next time. Thank you.